Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. In the Arab American enclave of Dearborn, Michigan, anxiety, depression, and substance abuse strain the 9/11 generation, according to today's guest, journalist Eli Kahan. He wrote a piece for Capital & Main and Rolling Stone called How Islamophobia is Driving a Mental Health Crisis Among Michigan's Muslim Youth. He found that according to FBI data, the number of assaults against Muslims leapt after Donald Trump's election in 2016 and persists at levels resembling those in 2001. Rates of anti-Arab hate crimes are the highest they've ever seen. Since the turmoil in the Middle East, anti-Islam sentiment has grown further still, according to the FBI. Joining us to discuss media coverage of Islamophobia and his investigation is Eli Kahan, an investigative journalist and pediatrician at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Hi, Eli. Thanks so much for this important piece, and thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
Well, as we always do on Fridays, Eli, we begin the show by talking about a piece of reporting that stood out for you this week. So what caught your attention?
Yeah, I have to say mine is a bit of a throwback. I have been down a child welfare rabbit hole, and I had the opportunity to reread an investigation from New York Magazine called What Happened to Maya, which is the inspiration of a Netflix documentary of the same name, which takes a deep dive on two very different sides of the story in a notorious child welfare case. And so I loved rereading that.
And where was that?
That was in New York Magazine.
New York Magazine. Okay. Thank you for that. I just wanted to mention one also. The New Yorker has a devastating piece by Eliza Griswold called The Children Who Lost Limbs in Gaza. And Dr. Ghassan Abousita, a British Palestinian reconstructive surgeon, said this is the biggest cohort of pediatric amputees in history. There's such a sad photo of this little girl, Ghazal, who's missing her leg. And it's just devastating, but such an important story. And I just wondered, Eli, given that you focused on Muslim youth in Dearborn and talked about the anxiety, the depression, the substance abuse that they are dealing with, what were the conversations you were having with them about what is happening in Gaza?
Yeah, you know, I have to say, first of all, I know Hassan very well from a different story that I'm working on, and they could not have picked a better source than Dr. Abousita. He's incredible. I think the conversations that I had sort of took two tenors, one which was markedly universal in the sense of a lot of people in Dearborn feel like this story is not unique to them. The opiate epidemic is not unique to them. The intergenerational trauma of fleeing a country due to any number of circumstances, including conflict, is not unique to them. And yet, there certainly are unique facets to the story in Muslim communities and in Dearborn specifically, which, of course, is not the only Muslim community. But it's worth noting that it is the densest Shia Muslim community in the U.S. Shia Muslims have had a very different lived experience in America, given the nature of the countries that Shia Muslims come from, among which is Iran, who is kind of the boogeyman for American foreign policy when it relates to Islam. And so I think at once they felt like they were part of this universal American tragedy, and at the same time uniquely targeted in ways that we get into in the piece.
What sparked this investigation? Because you wrote this again for Capital & Main and Rolling Stone, and it's very extensive. You interviewed a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, I guess this investigation, like many good stories, started at a bonfire. I was sitting with one of my very dear friends at a mutual faculty mentor's house back when I was in school at Stanford. And she is from Dearborn, Nadine Jawad. She's from Dearborn. She's just a phenomenal, amazing individual. And she mentioned almost in passing this phenomenon that her father, who washes bodies at the mosque there, one of the bigger mosques, his name is Kamel Jawad, that he had mentioned to her that he had seen more and more young men that he was having the honor and responsibility of doing this ritual body washing for them. And the way she mentioned it was, kind of at once inured and horrified and normalized, maybe. And I stopped her and I said, "Nadine, what are you talking about?" And it was down that rabbit hole that we fell together to unpack where those tragedies were coming from and what the root cause of the mental illness that many of those individuals were suffering, where we could track that mental illness.
Wow. And then you got data. I mean, you interviewed David Brogan, chief of Dearborn Heights Fire Department and Emergency Medical Services, who said, over the past 10 years, it's been increasing at a pretty steady rate. We're in a situation now where we get a call that someone in their 30s or under is unconscious. We pretty much assume it's an overdose. And just again, it's important to repeat this. The opioid overdose death rate in men aged 20 to 39 in Dearborn has reached 4 times the national average and over 2.5 times the state average, according to data from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services.
Yeah, and I think it sort of gets to the point of this story starts as far back as you're willing to look. I mean, for some people, this is a post-pandemic story of a group who are uniquely suffering, like many youth and young adults across the country. To some people, this story starts in 2016 with one of Trump's actual first official action in office, which was the so-called Muslim ban. Or to other people, to historians and other people who are familiar with the history of counterterror in this country, it traces back to the 1950s and the very inception of the counterterror program and the counterterror program in the United States, specifically as it relates to Muslim populations and Muslim populations being, if not synonymous, very tightly correlated with the idea of terror from the J. Edgar Hoover days.
Right. And for context, I mean, you go back to Hoover, but it's important to remember that surveillance in Muslim American communities amplified following 9/11. As you write, every president since George W. Bush has played a role. You write about informants. Dearborn is particularly targeted by law enforcement agencies, second only to New York City. Police camera surveillance systems with facial recognition technology have proliferated amongst greater Dearborn schools and storefronts. Also, just that the section in your piece, and this is for context, and then we'll talk about the people you interviewed. The section in your piece about informants was pretty disturbing. Can you talk about what you learned?
Yeah, you know, Rose, tracking this down, as you can imagine, it's a challenge, and the law enforcement agencies, for some reasons entirely justifiable and other reasons difficult to endure as an investigative journalist, have not been particularly forthcoming with information about anything related to their informant programs or their other methods of surveillance. So a lot of sort of where I looked and the kinds of initiatives that I was looking at were inspired by the shoulders of giants in terms of previous journalists and generations of journalists. When you start thinking back to, you know, the Patriot Act and all the journalists who were doing amazing work covering the earliest days of the Patriot Act after 2001, you know, all of these different initiatives were initiatives that took shape at different points in American history, you know, frankly, most of them since 2001, and they've grown with the times. And so, as you can imagine, the social media presence of law enforcement probably was not incredibly robust in 2002, but in 2018, by 2018, it did and has become a very important part of how law enforcement thinks about targeting and investigating folks. And I think you can sort of look towards these seminal cases of, we all maybe remember stories of Americans flying to Syria or allegedly flying to Syria to fight for ISIS and them having been indoctrinated by ISIS over social media. And that was the growth, the social media dimension of the way counterterrorism agencies focus on specific individuals.
You tell the story of a number of people. Let's just go over a few of them. You write, for Zainab, the cutting started in middle school decades after her parents moved to Dearborn from Iraq. For Suha, by Eid in 2021, when her own anxiety took over, her older brother had moved back, her youngest brother was addicted, her middle brother died from an overdose. For Qasem, his 29th birthday marked the year when he became too afraid to leave home. His three closest friends were dead and he developed a crippling agoraphobia. He said, I was so afraid of people, it got really dark. Later that year, he hung a belt on the ceiling, stepped onto a chair and tried to take his own life. And as you report, Eli, these are all natives of Dearborn and they're only in their 20s.
Yeah. I don't know what I expected, Rose, when frankly, Nadine and I went there over Ramadan for the first time. We went together for this story over Ramadan in 2021. And I'm not sure what either of us expected in terms of the kinds of stories or whether people would be willing to share anything at all with us. I think mental health is deeply stigmatized in lots of different communities across the U.S. for lots of different reasons. And certainly, you know, Dearborn's community is no exception. And I think we heard harrowing story after harrowing story that really grabbed us by the lapels and said, if we ever had any question that we had to report this story in a way that would do these individuals trusting us justice, that we were obligated to do so. I think the other thing that we thought a lot about, me and my editors at Capital Maine and Rolling Stone, who I am just so grateful to for what this piece has become over time. We spent a lot of time thinking about how do we ensure that these individuals are not portrayed as victims? And I don't think that is necessarily a unique thought that we were having. I think there are a lot of journalists who think very hard about ascribing individuals agency rather than victimhood. And yet the circumstances here forced us to share some of these stories in a way that I think express just how dramatic and profound the distress individuals like these four, among many others, some of whom we quote in the story and others who we don't, is in the community right now.
Eli Kahan is a pediatrician at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School and an investigative journalist whose work has appeared in many publications, including The Washington Post and The LA Times. He wrote a piece for Capital and Maine and Rolling Stone called How Islamophobia is Driving a Mental Health Crisis Among Michigan's Muslim Youth. In the Arab American enclave of Dearborn, anxiety, depression, and substance abuse strain the 9/11 generation. If you have any questions or comments for Eli about this investigation, and then also we're going to talk about this, but what are your thoughts about media coverage, media contributing to the normalization of Islamophobia? Not sure if you saw that New York Times column by Thomas Friedman on February 2nd that got a lot of attention. He wrote a piece called Understanding the Middle East Through the Animal Kingdom, basically comparing different countries in the Middle East to bugs. And then there was a Wall Street Journal column February 2nd called Welcome to Dearborn, America's Jihad Capital. So what are your thoughts about media now that, you know, Trump is getting 24/7 coverage again? In the second half of the show, we're going to talk about the horrible things, racist things he said about immigrants. And then there was the Muslim ban. So what are your thoughts? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Eli, before we talk about media coverage, let's go a little deeper into some of the stories that you share in your piece about what is happening to Muslim youth in Dearborn. You start the piece talking about Rabi Darwish, who moved to Dearborn in 1989 when he was just 6 years old. He came of age in the 9/11 era and told you, quote, a society that sees you as the enemy. You write, in his life, there were whispers, informants infiltrating mosques and schools. His friends and neighbors were repeatedly stopped by state police at checkpoints. To deal with his trauma, he began medicating himself. So tell us more about Rabih Darwish.
Yeah, Rob is, in some sense, such a distillation of so many parts of this story in one person, and the things that he has lived through and overcome are unbelievable. And I think, you know, Rob's story, if nothing else, should serve to emphasize that the Patriot Act 2001, these are not sort of discrete events in a sepia history textbook that is, we have to dust off when we take off the shelves. I mean, these circumstances are just so real for Rob, and they haven't changed. They haven't changed, Rose. And each iteration of Islamophobia that comes, each new wave, each new rebranding of Islamophobia, or, you know, counterterror programs that are, you know, deliberately entering and in some ways fracturing the community, that these are not subtle and nor are they ancient. And I think, you know, Rob, in his own journey, so this is a guy who came to the United States when he was young. He grew up in Dearborn, which again is the densest Shia Muslim community in the U.S. And when you sort of walk through Dearborn, it really is an at once, you know, insular and marvelously cosmopolitan community, in the sense of the number of cultures that have found their way to Dearborn and who see some of themselves in Dearborn as a new home in this country. And he comes there and he grows up in these schools and he finds himself in the crosshairs, as he told me, from any number of different initiatives, as subtle as, you know, sort of this cross-reporting between police and school resource officers and the counterterror agencies, to, you know, police having these checkpoints in the main arteries of town. And for Rabih, that led to sort of, you know, an accumulation of mental illness, like many of the youth that we spoke with, that ultimately, in an era of fentanyl and opiates and other drugs, turned into a chemical dependency, into substance use that he was using to self-medicate these emotions. Since that journey, after, you know, over a decade of his journey with chemical dependency, he has since recovered. He is now one of the community's foremost sort of young leaders when it comes to airing out the conversation around substance use, and he's taken on so many roles, more roles than any one person should have time in the day to take on, to do what he can to use his story to advance a conversation and to try to make sure that the community's next generation doesn't have to endure what he did.
Let's spend a little bit of time now talking about media coverage of these issues. Can you talk about what your thoughts are on how media has contributed to the normalization of Islamophobia? I think it's important. You write about the Wall Street Journal op-ed. It's also important to highlight this Thomas Friedman New York Times column on February 2nd called Understanding the Middle East Through the Animal Kingdom. He was heavily criticized for writing, "The U.S. is like an old lion. We are still the king of the Middle East jungle, more powerful than any single actor. But we have so many scars from so many fights that we just can't show up, roar loudly, and expect that everyone will do what we want or scamper away. Iran is to geopolitics what a recently discovered species of parasitoid wasp is to nature. What does the parasitoid wasp do? According to Science Daily, the wasp injects its eggs into live caterpillars, and the baby wasp slowly eats the caterpillar from the inside out, bursting out once they've eaten their fill. Is there a better description of Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq today? They are caterpillars." I mean, this is just kind of head spinning. And this is like one of the main columnists at the New York Times, beyond head spinning, of course. You're just thinking, what are you doing here? And then on February 2nd, Stephen Stilinski wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal called Welcome to Dearborn, America's Jihad Capital. Politico reported that Dearborn ramped up its police presence in response to the fallout from that piece. Dearborn Mayor Abdullah Hamoud said that city police increased security at places of worship and major infrastructure points as a direct result of that piece. So what are your thoughts on this?
I think I dissociated as much as you did, Rose. I think I probably can't put better words to it than Abdullah Hamoud Ken, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times on February 20th, sort of in direct response to both of these op-eds. And we write about both of the op-eds in the piece. I think, you know, the idea that any metaphor that construes a group of humans as animals, let alone sort of the lowest form of animal life, is probably not responsible opinion writing. It's probably not responsible publishing. It certainly is not productive. It certainly doesn't advance any sort of conversation. It's just inflammatory. And I think, you know, when I went back to the community, and again, we were working on this, and this started as a, you know, post-pandemic story, and it sort of morphed into a, you know, Israel-Gaza conflict story. And then as these sorts of commentaries were coming out, it was more than just, you know, once again, sort of Muslim individuals are finding themselves in the abstract subject to the world's ire and heuristics, but it was being said very overtly in two of the largest, most influential media outlets in the country. And so I think when I went back to the community, among other people, Syed Saleh Al-Kazwini, who's one of the, you know, imams in the community, he does a lot of work with the younger generation in particular, just said, you know, Eli, this just rhymes with post 9/11. It just calls back a lot of those thoughts. And I think that says all you need to know in terms of how this was felt, embodied in the community and individuals in the community, and what it meant for people's day-to-day life in terms of their security, you know, having to step up security at people's schools. I mean, how else can you express the fear that a community feels other than saying they thought their kids were in enough danger that they had to put more people in place to defend them?
And I have to say, I mean, the other story you tell about Khalil Abu Rayyan, this was another incredible story, and it makes you wonder, are informants right now targeting Muslim youth? What is the U.S. government's policy on this? It's a long story, and I hope that listeners can take the time to read about Khalil. But there's a lot going on in his life. During 2001, he said, everything changed. We were to blame. Now you're not this immigrant trying to live the American dream. You're an outsider. He ended up falling in love, and we learn that this person he thought he was going to marry was actually an FBI informant. I mean, it's a devastating story. And Eli, I just wondered, is this going on right now?
Well, Rose, I wondered that too, and I asked that question, and needless to say, the agencies were not particularly forthcoming. I did receive a CD, which I had to figure out how to look at because my computer doesn't actually still have a CD player, but I got a CD from the FBI, and the CD had about 1,100 pages on it, the vast majority of which were a combination of very old and extremely retracted, like just completely blacked out, and many of them were duplicated. So I didn't get many answers from the agency. I think there's no reason to believe when the FBI director has gone out and said, we're increasing surveillance, we're increasing scrutiny, we're stepping up the way we think about surveillance and monitoring and enforcement, in, you know, the age of the Israel-Gaza war, to think that they have radically changed any of the strategies that they've adopted over the past two decades and more. And I also would just encourage listeners to understand that this kind of surveillance, this kind of monitoring is not unique to Khalil, is not unique to Dearborn, is not unique to Muslims. I mean, there are many, many groups that are routinely surveilled across the country. There's decades of reporting to corroborate the extent of routine surveillance that happens on lots of different populations. And so, you know, whether or not you're interested in Khalil's story, you're interested in Dearborn's story, you're interested in the story of you know, Islamophobia in pockets of the country right now, I think it's still worth trying to understand the strategies that the counterterror agencies use, and frankly, the amount of impunity with which they use these techniques, knowing that there's not a heck of a lot of accountability, because reporters like me try really hard and don't get very far in terms of getting documents or other evidence to shine a light on some of these techniques. Now, I should say for jurisprudence, like, I had an ongoing conversation with the FBI and they were forthcoming, and I spoke with Mary Abojude, who, you know, is doing some like really important work. And I don't want to say that none of this work is valuable in any way. Certainly, you know, ensuring the safety of the country against legitimate threats is deeply important. But I don't think that, you know, safety and ensuring safety need come at the profound cost of transparency that it feels like it has in some ways.
Eli, before we let you go, I just want to swing back to the first question I asked you. What stood out for you when you talked to people in Dearborn about the Biden administration's unconditional support for Israel? Jacobin had a piece yesterday called "Joe Biden is Shipping Weapons to Israel Every 36 Hours." When the primary was in Michigan last month, there was a major campaign to get people to vote for uncommitted to send a message to the Biden administration, and 100,000 people in Michigan voted uncommitted. So what did you hear from young people about the Biden administration?
You know, I think a lot of people are asking themselves the question, what does solidarity mean now? And as I tried to rack my brain going into the election, what historically the Democratic platform has been about, the word that stands out to me is solidarity. It feels like most Democratic policies historically of the Democratic Party, I should say, not democracy in general, but of the current iteration of the Democratic Party, fancy themselves the veneer of solidarity. And so what I heard when I spoke with members of the community, and as I continue to, is that they're the kind of solidarity that they expected, it turns out, doesn't really apply to them. And they're just not really entitled to it. And so I think part of my interest, again, in this story was because I had a very dear friend who had an insane story to tell that was premised on decades of, lack of government accountability and other things, sure. So in that way, that was what this story is about. But to me, this story was also about, like, who's deserving of solidarity in this country? And I think that's a question that the people who find themselves, you know, uncommitted, by definition, that word tells you they don't know that they fit into any sort of mainstream representation right now. And that says to me, the very word uncommitted says there are people in this country who don't know where to go and don't have a political home, at least in part, because they don't feel appreciated and they don't feel like their suffering is worth the same amount as the suffering of other groups.
Eli Kahan is an investigative journalist whose work has appeared in many publications, including The Washington Post and The LA Times. He just wrote a piece for Capital and Maine and Rolling Stone called "How Islamophobia is Driving a Mental Health Crisis Among Michigan's Muslim Youth." He's also a pediatrician at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Eli, thank you so much for this important reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose, for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. And you can find Eli's piece and more about his work at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about Texas's SB4 deportation law. Hours after the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the law to go into effect, a federal appeals court blocked officials from enforcing it. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.